Welcome back. This is the Coaches Rising podcast. I'm delighted today to be joined by Amy Elizabeth Fox and Nicholas Yanni, and we are gathering to talk about their new book, Leading in Chaos, which is a clarion call to a new future from these pioneers in leadership development. So we're going to be exploring some of the big ideas in this book today, including how can we lead in chaos? What are these times we find ourselves in? What is the invitation being made to leaders and also to transformational practitioners, facilitators, and coaches working with leaders? So we'll go into the importance of trauma-informed work and Nicholas and Amy's experience working with thousands of leaders. And what does it mean to be of service, to be a blessing field in our times? This was a delightfully rich conversation. A couple more words about who our guests are today, in case you don't know them. Nicholas Yanni is an internationally respected leadership coach and teacher and speaker. He's the author of Leader as Healer. And Amy Elizabeth Fox is a renowned leadership advisor. She's the CEO of Mobius Executive Leadership, who are known for their pioneering work in transformational change and trauma-informed leadership. So we're in good hands today. So let's dive in. Here's the podcast with Nicholas and Amy. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So dear Amy and Nicholas, it's a joy to have you both looking at me on the screen like this. It's really a joy. And we're here for a great reason too, like this book that you've both brought into the world and Leading in Chaos. So we're going to unpack some of the reasons why you created that book and the invitation, I think, the powerful invitation inside that book today. Well, how are each of you, first of all? I know you've got a big day today.
Yeah, we're doing a book launch this evening, Joel, and it's such a delight to get to be with you and the Global Coaches Rising family on this day in particular. I'm really joyous to be with you and to be with Nicholas.
Yeah, likewise, wonderful to be with you, Joel. And we're excited to book launch. The whole process with the book is a rich and powerful journey for us.
Let's dive right into that. As we were checking in, you talked about transmission actually, and that was actually the first place I wanted to go. I found this a very powerful book to read. It felt very evocative to read it, and I wonder what, for each of you, your intended transmission for this book is. Like, what's it serving in the world?
Nicholas, why don't you go first? I'll build on what you say.
Thank you, Joel. I mean, that's a crucial question. Actually, I was out walking early this morning in the park, and I was reflecting, and I got some new insights. So, first of all, if I track my journey of awakening and healing my trauma, and that'll be forever, and then I put that with my reading of the traditions, what they're saying about this time. What they said about this time, and then I tune into what's happening in the world. It makes me more sure than ever that we're at a pivotal moment, and we're at a pivotal moment of consciousness shift, and that everything that's happening now, all the chaos and now the war, everything is a consequence of an old paradigm, an old consciousness that's separate, that's disconnected, that's not based in the heart. And if I feel my journey, even this year, which already from the beginning I felt was opening new portals outwardly and inwardly, I find myself with a new level of access to the unified field, which all the traditions have written about. Or I would sometimes call it the one heart. And it's new. I feel it's something new in me. And it gives me the sense even more that that is exactly what's needed now. That is exactly the collective shift point humanity has arrived at. It's what the traditions said. So if you ask about the transmission of the book, I think my deepest wish is that it would transmit that field of love, because the unified field, I feel emotional as I say that, is a field of capital L love. That is the consciousness that has always been spoken about as the core of who we are. And it's like we got really seriously lost. We got seriously into what I call exile. And it's my deepest wish is that each of us and all of us come home. I'm very emotional today. That we come home. We come home because we're really lost. And look what's happening in the world.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful answer. Maybe I would just add this, Joel. I think we both feel like there's no time to waste in the inflection point that we're in collectively and globally to have the conversations that have gone unspoken and unhealed for a very, very long time, generations. And so, in some ways, in my mind, the book is a transmission of intimate truth. Of what actually has gone on in our lives as families, as communities, as collectives, what all the points of fracture, fragmentation, and trauma are, and what a pathway for healing and expansion looks like. So, on one level, the book is exactly as you said, meant to be provocative and confrontative in some ways, and invitational to ask people to tell the real stories of their lives and to look in the rooms of their house that they don't often dwell in or engage, often unconscious content. And at the same time, to participate in a kind of renaissance or movement of renewal and love that has the possibility to rewire all the cultural agreements we operate by and all the ways that organizational culture is dehumanizing, can we believe be changed and far more wholesome going forward. So it's at one level a gritty description of what is true, and at the second level, it's a prayer for what is possible.
Yeah. And also a bit of a roadmap because it's been particularly touching in some of the reviews when people comment about how rooted it is in our experience of working in the field with leaders. It's not an abstract theoretical book. And that seems very important. And everything Amy said reminds me of why I'm so honored to be co-author of this book with
I feel very much the same.
Before we maybe unpack that roadmap a little bit more, I wonder if you could say something about the world right now, because the book is a very powerful invitation and it's full of hope in a sense of this path. And our field in general, this field of transformational practitioners and coaches, I think really care about helping leaders to deepen and find access to ways of collaborating and leading that lead to a sustainable future for us all. And yet, if we look at the world right now and the sense of chaos, to speak to the title of the book and the uncertainty and the seeming way that maybe many leaders are not acting from this place that we're advocating for. Like, could you just say something about how, because people might be going, yeah, it sounds great, but where are these leaders?
I think one of the things that happens in chaos is leaders and practitioners alike are in a state of disorientation and confusion. It's really hard to make meaning and sense make out of a constantly volatile and dangerous, environment. So one of the things the book tries to do early on is to give us diagnostic lens to ground us all in a shared interpretation of what are the root causes of what the kind of fragmentation and polarization and escalating violence that we're seeing rooted in untreated trauma. And I think that by definition is grounding because we start to begin to know, as Nicholas said a moment ago, what the roadmap or pathway out of the problem is. If you're just living within the symptoms of a constantly swirling, constantly seemingly random set of circumstances bombarding you constantly with stress and pressure and anxiety, it's very hard to get grounded and focused on what you can contribute. So that's one thing I would say. I think the book is oriented. The second thing I would say is that I think as practitioners, we owe it to ourselves to disproportionately attend to resourcing and things that are inspiring and expansive and nurturing, because it's our job to help co-regulate and ground leaders in a context in which they are under increasing pressure. So I think the book is also a call for renewal and practices that of self-care, of rigorous self-care for practitioners, because otherwise we won't have a waterfall of beauty to offer to the clients who are struggling themselves. So that's what I would start with. What would you add, Nicholas?
Beautiful. Well, it's such an important question, Joel. So I'm going to start with the fact that the world, or at least a big part of it, is very present in this household here. My stepdaughter is spending three quarters of each day in a bomb shelter in Israel. The news is horrendous. And I say that because, I think exactly what's being called for now, and my wife is even more affected than I am, obviously being Israeli. It's calling for us to be in a consciousness that it can embrace and hold that and not be consumed completely by it, meaning to be able to hold and meet that and still be connected to a deeper field, a field of love, a field of light, whatever you want to call it. And that is what's I think, the new consciousness that's needed now. Because if we only see the news, then we think, well, this is just mumbo jumbo, or what's the point? But as we know, and maybe it's getting a bit esoteric to talk about it, everything is about frequency. So the world news is at a certain frequency, and it's hugely destructive and painful. And we're in what Joanna Macy called the great unraveling. And there is a much higher frequency available. And I meet that, by the way, every time I'm in Israel very strongly. There's this level where life is like kind of catastrophic, but the high frequency is completely there if we can feel it. So I feel very strongly that's what we're called to now. And it's just an addition to what Amy is saying about how do we resource ourselves. And I'm not, you see, I don't, this, maybe we'll get into this in it also in more detail, but I don't think it's about what's going to happen. I don't do the work, this work, because I hope things are going to get much better. I do in one way, but that's not the deepest motivation. It's to stand in that frequency and let that frequency come through, and that's the best I can do in a way. And everyone I know. I don't know, I hope I'm making sense there. It goes back to that Vaclav Havel quote, that hope is not about something necessarily getting better. Hope is that you know what you're doing makes sense, whatever the outcome. We don't know the outcome. That's way beyond what we can know. But we do know that there is this different possibility of consciousness available. And has been written about for millennia, and is we're at that tipping point now where it has to be born more and more. How that will happen, what will happen, I don't know. But I don't feel, I neither feel hopeful or hopeless. It's not even in that polarity.
And the book operates at multiple levels of consciousness. So some of the book is written in very organizational development and leadership language. Some of the book is a call to look at the history of colonialism, of violence, of ecological degradation, of social injustice, inequity economically. Some of it is very specifically looking at what's out of alignment in the social order that is now in motion. And then it ends up or culminates in a, we hope, a very compelling description of the spiritual possibility of living in a more transpersonal and relational and sane way on the planet. So it's in, by design, not a spiritual bypass, but a very concrete focus on what's not working and what needs to repair.
Right. And you know, we each lead programs and work with people one to one, where we start with you know, a very often a very contracted, quite numb energy field, because that is what we've been living in. So we know the journey of how that starts to melt, how that starts to open, and the different gateways of that process.
Maybe I can weave together some of the things you're saying into a question here. So it sounds like there's this journey that we can make out of this collective trauma field and the activation that can occur that we live from into a place of deeper contact and intimacy with our experience, whereby, as you say, Nicholas, we're not now reacting, trying to save things or defend things as much as meeting life in a different way. And maybe there's a kind of field we can hold as a leader, a metabolization. You know, I've been thinking about this idea of like being a vessel that allows chaos to cohere, you know, being a field. And so I just want to combine that reflection with what you said about the news. And how that, you know, if you tune in just to the news, it can feel like, where on earth are we going to find a way through this? But I
Sure.
think what each of you said about working with leaders, you know, in real life, are you seeing leaders who are responding in the way that you're advocating for, and going on this journey, and that maybe, like, yeah, if you watch the news, it seems quite hopeless, but actually in real life, people are transforming, people are shifting already.
I think
Many.
part of the trauma field of the current zeitgeist is that it hypnotizes us to believe we can't make a change or that people are unreachable. In the numbness that Nicholas referenced, we start to believe and get entrained to believe that it's not possible or it would take endless amounts of time for things to be otherwise. But that's not our experience in our, actual work with leaders. Our experience is often organizations are skeptical or concerned that it wouldn't work there, that people won't want to have an open heart, that people don't have that level of trust and safety, that people aren't willing to do their inner work. And of course, it does take some skill and some expertise to make the correct invitation and to meet people where they start, as Nicholas referenced earlier. But when you do have those capacities to create an appropriate container for people to take a journey of self-contact and self-healing and self-revelation, my experience, and I think Nicholas's will bear this out as well, is that most people yearn to come home. And not only do they care to address their own unconscious habits and derailers and pain and hurt, but they long to accompany each other in the journey home. And they take great joy in comforting, in witnessing, in celebrating one another. So I think our book is an attempt to testify to the possibility that actually many organizations could be operating differently if we were, as practitioners, making the appropriate invitation.
I meet many leaders who are absolutely up for the journey and indeed on it. I had a remarkable experience a month or so ago here in London when I was invited to attend a senior team meeting in an ultra conventional organization in the city. And Amy will know who I'm talking about. And they've done a lot of the kind of work that we advocate in the book. I was so amazed. I'd never seen a senior team for 2 hours conduct a meeting that was required a lot of financial analysis about a particular project and regularly stop to process everyone's emotions. I mean, it was like, wow, okay. And we spoke afterwards about even them becoming a kind of beacon because people need to know that that's happening, and people need to know that's happening also because they work much better. It's not happening just for personal development. I meet many leaders at the IMT. I often have 40 global leaders, and we start from a very close place, but I have 2.5 days, and by day two, things really change. And something Amy said particularly, because the beginning is really like we don't do vulnerability. No. And then somewhere in day two, I actually get them writing very personally. And they then go in small groups and they share what they've been writing. And the floodgates open always. It's unbelievable. And one of the things that is most powerful for them in that is to see that everyone is carrying hurt and pain and fear and grief. Everyone. And because the whole thing in the old paradigm, as well as Amy said, is, oh, maybe it's just me. Maybe everyone else is fine. So there's this group process of, wow, we're all human, and it's so powerful to share it. And I always ask each group when they come back, because they're from multiple organizations, if you were a team having gone through this, do you think you'd be performing better? Of course we would. There's no doubt because they're energized, their hearts are open, and they're having all kinds of insights and ideas. So it's very, on one level, it's very practical, this.
I'm thinking of an organization who maybe is the same one you're referring to, but this person said, and they were doing a lot of deep work, and they said they interact with government agencies, and they said, people started saying to them, like, we don't know what it is about you guys, but we love collaborating with you. Like, there's something different about you, and the work you do is brilliant. So, yeah.
And I think that's important, Joel, because it's as Nicholas said, we're not advocating this purely for personal development. We genuinely believe that what we're calling in the book next practices lead to greater psychological safety, lead to greater innovation, lead to greater cross-functional and cross-boundary collaborations, lead to more audacity of aspirations to serve the planet. We believe that these have concrete implications for the ROI of the business and the social good of how they contribute. So, in that sense, we're very passionate about helping organizations and leaders to embrace some of these practices because we really do believe in the business benefit and the social benefit.
I'd love to ask you about maybe we get to the roadmap a little bit here, but and I want to also contextualize this in terms of coaches and transformational practitioners listening. Maybe you could each speak to, what's key in this journey that you're advocating for to lead in chaos. And, Nicholas, you've talked about awakening and healing, and Amy, you have like vertical and horizontal development. I think they kind of fit together really beautifully. What's the terrain of this journey?
The terrain has to start with a slowing down because everyone is in that kind of rhythm, which keeps people up and not feeling themselves, not feeling their body, not feeling their emotions. So first of all, there has to be a cognitive map about why that's important, and that's quite easy to, it's quite simple in a way. And then the work has to, certainly in my journeys, and I'm sure Amy's is a similar, there has to be like a reconnection to the body. So I do deep, simple somatic work. 20, 30 minutes, after which people are sitting in their chairs often with, like, wow, I didn't know I could feel like this, like that they're in a different frequency. And the key gateway, at least for a first part of the journey, is always the emotional, because that's where we're most protected. And that is ultimately a question of safety. Could it be safe enough that I can actually let myself feel? And that's a really, it's like a huge threshold that, because once we're through that threshold, we're really, the whole field changes. And also people are, as you know, I always speak about the mind being the servant, not the master. And at first, all the questions are very intellectual and but after that threshold, people are asking what I would call real questions, like coming from a much deeper place. So the whole dialogue shifts to a much deeper level and things click. It's like pennies drop inside. And then we can get on to topics like purpose and what are you really here for? What are you really loving? What are you passionate about? And also the whole topic of listening. What does it mean to really be here, listen to each other in a much deeper way, be available for higher levels of ideas to come through? So it's all a interwoven. I call it sometimes putting the USB plug back in, because it's like we took it out from all our systems and located ourselves in this thinking modality, which is very, very limited and doesn't actually feel the world. People need to realize you can't feel anything with your thinking. It's so simple, but if you're here, you literally don't feel the world. And then you need huge substances and everything to have a kind of actual feeling of the world. So I really do. I say, we're going to put the USB plug back in the body. We're going to put the USB plug back into our emotional body. We're going to put it back into our intuition. We're going to put it back into our capacity to reside in a much bigger, more silent space. And that's the roadmap, at least as much as it can be simply said. It's very concrete.
Yeah, I love what Nicholas said about the importance of unnumbing and being in a greater degree of emotional contact, emotional expression, emotional cradling by the group. I think that's all beautiful. We also do somatics and contemplative practice and what David White calls the poetics. I think artistry and ex self-expression are part of the pathway. But to just speak for a moment, Joel, to what you brought in about the horizontal and the vertical dimension, which I think adds to what Nicholas said, one of the ways that we're in great pain is that we are too isolated in our own experience, our own trembling, our own longing, our own uniqueness. There isn't a fabric of interdependence. There's this all this emphasis on autonomy and resilience. Resilience in a corporate setting means you don't need anything from me. It's the most unnatural way of walking you could ever do your life. So part of what we're trying to advocate gets restored is the entwining of people to be actually caring for each other, to know personal details about one another's lives, to be consecrating their work together in a field of real corporate intimacy, and relational needs, a vocabulary of relational support and relational requests, which most leaders just don't have. So I think the interpersonal or horizontal dimension, Nicholas mentioned skills for listening. There's also skills for co-regulation and helping each other to stay grounded under very chaotic and crisis moments that we're having more and more. There's many skills, nuanced skills of how to build on each other's ideas and ideate together into real collective intelligence with people being able to influence each other and disagree with each other and have robust, productive conflict. So that's the horizontal dimension. Just to add and round out to what we're saying, the vertical dimension is also an invitation for people to see spirituality or a relationship to grace, sharing of blessings that everyone has had in their lives, to take out of the closet the numinous and bring it into the resource of any organization that wants to achieve a high purpose, that wants to do something ambitious and profound for the world, that wants to take the best of everybody's gifts and generatively cohere them into a collective offering. I think at some point we have to admit that we can't do it in purely intellectual or material plain terms. The inspiration of the future descends from a field of deep questing and willingness to receive and a willingness to be guided. And I think we're starting to talk about executive maturity. Some facet of that maturity includes a quality of surrender and a quality of service.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And can I add one thing? I draw on often a very simple metaphor from the traditions, which is that when you open a book, you have all the black letters and you have a white page that is of a totally different dimension. And why do we say in English, the idea came to me? So everyone says that. So once we get a sense, and then of course I also do a lot of meditative practice with groups. And once we begin to get a sense of the feeling of that, that's a very big thing, because everyone then understands, yeah, I have felt that occasionally, but I'm mostly just lost in the black letters. And then there are practices, I teach practices about actually walking through your day in touch with both. That's why I love Rumi's famous statement, live in the nowhere that you come from, even though you have an address here. And for
Oh,
me,
that's
that's
perfect.
about learning, and it's a very real practice. I have a way of teaching it, to walk in both realities. Because when a team does that, it's like the whole roadmap of reality got so big compared to this. And then we're open to these ideas coming. Then ideas can come.
Another way to say what Nicholas is pointing to is that you're teaching people to have one leg in the current reality and one leg anchored in eternity at all times.
Exactly.
And there are concrete practices, having people paint together, having people read and study poetry, engaging with scripture, engaging with the art of creating your own and activating your own voice. All of those things give you practices of being guided and receiving information. And just to be more personal for one second, I would say part of the reason this book happened is that twice in meditation, I was given the title Leading in Chaos. And the first time I just thought, oh, that's a brilliant title, and I ignored it. And the second time I realized it was a direction and that we had to do something about it. So I think it happens exactly as Nicholas said. We call that intuition, but I'm certain it's also a communion with higher realms.
Yeah, and it's like downloads, and when the idea comes, it's like a download. And I think for me, having worked 20, 25 years in the theatre, in the arts, we were daily in this white page, daily, because there's no creativity in the arts without that. But also many scientists know, when you start really talking with them, they know exactly what I'm talking about.
Even as we talk about it, I can notice a kind of sense of inspiration, a felt sense of inspiration start to
Yeah.
permeate. And, Amy, you just shared there, one practice being in a meditative space that then, these thoughts, these ideas can come unbidden and
Yes.
hit, strike us. And I wonder, maybe we could. And Nicholas, you said there is a practice you do. Would you be open to sharing a little bit of a practice? And Amy, you can also, if you want to add more.
Okay. Is that okay, Amy, that I'll do something? Okay. I mean, it's a practice that has endless levels, but it starts with a simple attentional practice, because I see that our capacity to pay attention is one of our biggest superpowers, because it immediately, even measurably, changes our brainwave frequency. It's very interesting. When someone is wired up and you guide them to pay attention, their brainwave frequency measurably changes. They move from beta wave frequency towards alpha wave frequency, which is the zone in sports. It's the zone that any creative activity takes place in. So the simplest thing we could do now is to activate our attention, not stop thinking, but place ourselves as the one who is paying attention, and just bring our attention down to our breathing. And just notice for a moment, not trying to change anything, simply noticing all the sensations, all the movements. The thinking kind of goes into the background. We become the ones who are paying attention. We notice him. And then the one intentional thing we could do is to soften the out-breath. Soften the out-breath, relax the out-breath. So you have a sense maybe of dropping down more towards your base, towards your sitting in your seat. And just noticing, because sensations are continuously changing and new ones arising. And we're simply curious. Wow, this world of sensations. And maybe I notice my legs more suddenly. I feel my feet touching the ground. And then I begin to notice this kind of space inside, more space around me, inside me. And I'm at the portal of the white page simply by this action of paying attention. So I brought my attention back and I brought it down into my body. And I call that a backward circle. Back and down. So I feel more here. I feel more here in my body, and I also have more space. So that's a very simple beginning. But then I can also understand that moment to moment, whoever I'm with, or whatever meeting I'm in, or whatever I'm doing, I can actually check, am I in a backward circle or the opposite, which is the forward circle, where I'm up and I'm out. I'm towards the world rather than I'm here and I let the world come to me. And many practices teach that. The Alexander technique, for instance, is based on that. This is very simple at the beginning. And many, many leaders I work with report that it radically changes how they participate in meetings. Suddenly I'm more here, and my whole perceptual field is much bigger. Because it includes my thinking, but it also has activated a quite different faculties of perception. And it's not that I have to act slowly. From here, I could go really fast if I needed to. I could be fierce if I needed to. But I'm coming from here, coming from here. It's game changing, actually, because our habitual way of being is forward. I learned this from a Zen master about 30 years ago and it's stayed with me ever since, and I've got deeper and deeper into what it really means. Because that's the gateway to what Amy said so powerfully, having one leg here and one leg in the world of eternity, because the white page is the river, a field of eternity. And we can learn to walk through the day, whatever is happening. It's a high practice, and we just keep developing.
It's beautiful what Nicholas said, and I actually think we could do a whole podcast on this question, Joel. Like, how do you actually widen your perceptive field, quiet your mind so that you're available to somatic intelligence, emotional intelligence, relational intelligence, fresh creative sparks of inspiration, all of that. I would just add one thing, which is, then we talk about this in the book. Part of the pandemic we're inside is a pandemic of superficial conversation. And one of the ways you start to make the help a leader to ask and access more profound knowing is you change the nature of the questions you're inviting them to engage. So in the opening night of my program, for example, I do a guided visualization where people, it's multifaceted, but for the purpose of this answer, people put their ancestry behind them, and I invite them to reflect on what were the strengths they were born into in their family lineage, what were the gifts they were given in their family lineage, but also what were the secrets that their family held, what was the pain in the country they were born into that their family had to grapple with. What are their ancestors asking them to heal and metabolize and lay to rest? And equally, I ask them to put future generations in front of them and to imagine what's theirs to bestow and who are they helping and who are they cradling and who is their responsibility? Who are they accountable to? And then we let people draw an image of that experience and then speak in small groups about what came to them. And they're, as Nicholas said, people are often very tearful. It invites people to drop the wall through which we mostly speak in superficial and routinized ways and start to have the real conversation. And the thing that we're pointing at, the ephemeral possibility, only can be accessed through the portal of the real conversation.
Joel, how are you doing? Because I sense you kind
Yeah, I'm doing good. I really appreciate it, the invitation you made. And I mean, also love
That
this
was so
conversation.
beautiful what Amy just said. Wow.
I think what I'm sat with is I'm imagining, therefore, when each of you are with leaders individually or with groups, then you're tracking the quality of the conversation, the frequency of the
Absolutely.
conversation, and where people are
Absolutely.
speaking from. And
100%.
the work is an invitation more deeply into the real conversation.
And I will sometimes give the group the metaphor of an elevator, right? You can have the conversation on the ground floor, you can have the conversation on the lower lobby, or you can have the conversation at the root, and make it a group responsibility to track how are we doing with that? How capable are we of granting one another access to what's in our interiority? And it's mostly not that we're afraid of telling it to each other. It's mostly that we're afraid to encounter what we normally try to numb. And that does take a while. It's a practice.
Beautiful. And maybe, I mean, it's coming into my mind, so you choose if you want to go here, Joel. But what is this calling coaches to step into? Do you want to go there now?
Absolutely. The phrase "be a blessing," what is the field came to my mind as well. So that might tap into this. So please just follow what came to you, Nicholas, if something
Well,
did.
one thing, because as you know, I'm running intensive 6 month training programs, and then quite a lot of people continue. I have one group who's in training for a year and a half. And I find myself from saying at a certain point that actually you need to be willing to also be a teacher for your clients. In the sense of standing clearly for something different to what they're used to, standing clearly for entering the kinds of conversations Amy is talking about, and standing clearly for repeatedly helping your client come back to their experience rather than their narrative, because that's the pandemic. Everyone goes into analysis and narrative rather than this is what's actually happening in me now. And it's a different calling, I think. A teacher maybe sounds a bit dramatic, but I feel there's something important about that now as a practitioner. And a lot of the people I work train who often very, very experienced, they go into a threshold of would I dare do this with my corporate clients because it's so not the normal corporate coaching. And it's inviting that obviously most of the training is about what space are you sitting in as a coach and how open is your perceptual field. You know, when I first met one of our very, very great teachers, Thomas Hubel, and I saw him work with people, and I was like, what? Like how you seeing so deep, so fast. I just never seen it. And I said, I was, how are you doing this? And he said, well, all the information is available. And I was like, well, I hear that, but it's definitely not for me. But over the years, it is more and more and more. And I'm training coaches to have that. To be sitting so deep in their heart openness and their embodied presence that the interior of the client effortlessly is available. Like every corner of their trauma, every corner of how their body is holding something. That's a very different training to most coaching training, which is much more cognitive based and strategic. So it is a blessing field that. Because you're coming in this deeply embodied, heart-open field. And it also, of course, brings in the all-important principle of radical inclusion. That everything, even when you said earlier, I just want to come back to you, said getting going out of trauma. No, we have to actually go right through it. with radical inclusion. There's no hierarchy of feeling. There's no trying to get to a better feeling. That's a radical principle for coaches to accept that. We're just trying to actually be here as fully with what is truly happening at every level. And that's a high calling coaching. And I love what happens when I see these experienced coaches start to work in this way. And they're often blown away by what starts to happen with their clients, even when they hold a little bit more of that space. I have a lot more to say, but that's, a start.
We have a question, and
Maybe,
maybe
maybe.
to weave you in, which is, about being a teacher. Like I hear in that, there's taking a stand, that,
Exactly.
and that stand affects the kind of invitation you are, the container you hold, and also invites you to your developmental edge. And I wonder, I think that's something maybe we don't talk to practitioners about so much, is like people learn so much from other people, and that's very powerful. But also, have you spent the time to articulate who you are as a practitioner and what stand you take? And I wonder if that's
Right.
something you do. I mean, I think that's what you're doing in the book, that's my
The
sense
book
of.
is us taking a stand. I mean, it couldn't be clearer.
Yeah, I think, Joel, what you're pointing to is that there are two general movements. There's directive coaching and there's facilitative coaching. And a lot of practitioners have been cultivating the listening, receptive, guiding, accompanying facet for a long time. And as people are craving more and more wisdom, more and more orientation, more and more adaptive capacity, I think practitioners are also going to have to be willing to offer their counsel, offer their confrontation, offer their, I don't know what quite the word is, cartography of development. Because people need to understand the landscape of how do you grow your consciousness and to have a map for how to create a cultivated inner life. And ultimately, I think that requires the practitioner having gone on their own deep journey. We're not going to accompany anybody anywhere in any terrain that we haven't already explored in ourselves. The ceiling on what people share with you, bring to you, confide in you, grant you authority to speak to them on, the ceiling is your inner development. Nicholas mentioned our teacher, Thomas. Thomas is constantly coming back to the notion that you are the instrument of the transformation of your client. And if I may, I really just want to bow, Joel, to the work that Coaches Rising is doing, because for years you have been pointing practitioners to this central tenet that doing your own inner work and doing your own inner healing and your own awakening journey is the most central and essential thing you can do if you want to have deeper and more profound impact with clients. And I think Nicholas and I believe that very deeply. And one of the things the book aspires to do is to give practitioners a bit of what that roadmap looks like.
That's a, I mean, that's 100% the essence. It has to be for anyone who's a practitioner that our work, and I speak for myself also, is continuous. And we can only hold people to the level that we feel we've been to and feel safe enough that nothing will throw us off if someone touches deep trauma or deep
Just to
pain.
share one anecdote. Last year, Thomas and I taught a year-long course on trauma-informed coaching and consulting to 200 practitioners from around the world. And they reported that as they got more comfortable exploring their own trauma and their own emotional terrain, automatically, they didn't have to change their questions or their technique or their coaching methodology. Automatically, they become a different field of invitation that produces clients sharing much deeper than they would have previously thought was possible or appropriate in a business context. So I feel very optimistic that these shifts communicate themselves body to body. They transmit a widening of the aperture of what's possible and appropriate to talk about in any individual session as the coach expands themselves.
Yes. And I like that. I mean, the cartography word is very important because at a certain moment, I think we have to draw the cartography of trauma, personal trauma, lineage trauma, collective trauma. I mean, I was fortunate enough to work with two African American CEOs, one of whom leads a huge organization, and neither of them had really even thought about the effect of the collective trauma of their race. And as we and I use the elevator, I use elevator in a slightly different way because it's like we go down and down and down emotionally and somatically till we hit that territory, that huge period of slavery was sitting in their whole psychophysical body and clearly affecting them in their everyday life. But that cartography has to be explained.
This is
Otherwise,
very important what Nicholas said.
what's happening here?
This is really important, and I just want to underscore it. People underestimate the degree to which individual, ancestral, and collective trauma is operating inside
Exactly.
of leaders, shaping their identity, shaping their self-esteem, shaping their ways of just making decisions, shaping their ability to create intimacy in the workplace. Many, 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 many things come from untreated trauma, unrecognized trauma, unnamed trauma. And part of the reason why organizations are so disembodied, dysfunctional, and dehumanized is because they're being led by and guided by people who have yet to start their inner work. So this is why it is a collective problem or a collective opportunity, I guess I would say.
What do you think about, because we've explored this in our trainings and our previous conversations individually, and one of the things we get in our trainings are people who say, and I understand this, like, but is this, are we moving into therapy here? Is this coaching? What is this? And on one hand, I think it's important to have that conversation. I think it's important to know your scope of practice, and that's ethically really important. And at the same time, I often feel like in myself, let me speak for myself, that it actually reveals more about my own developmental edge, where I feel fear with my client, with the territories we may go into. And I guess I'm in general asking you about, what's your sense of the call for practitioners in our times and in the ways they need to equip themselves and even view the territory of their work? Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that? Because, yeah.
I'll offer two, and Nicholas may see this very
Yes.
differently, actually. One is, I think it's irresponsible for anybody to be practicing the dialogue practices of group process or individual coaching without at least being hitting the threshold of being trauma-informed, training and understanding what hyperarousal and hypoarousal looks like, knowing what it means to be in the presence of somebody who's triggered and de-skilled, and knowing skills for co-regulation. I think that's the minimum bar, and I don't think it messes with the scope of what a coach should do versus what a therapist should do. That's one thing. And the second thing I would say is that for true vertical development, I do think it needs to be done by people who are therapeutically trained, trauma trained, what we call trauma restorative work, not trauma informed work. Trauma restorative work should be done by trauma trained therapists. And in my deeper leadership programs, I have a team of four, five, or sometimes six trauma therapists working with me in the program because we're inviting people to surface long held emotions, long held sensations, buried fears, unprocessed memories. And I would never do that in the absence of having people who can skillfully work with metabolizing what's arising. So I think the coaching field has to expand its versatility in trauma understanding, trauma and recognition, and trauma containment without breaching into the area of actually doing counseling work or doing trauma integration work, which I think should still be and needs to be done by people who have much more extensive training in that domain. But I'm very thrilled to say that I think increasingly people are knowing where their scope of practice is and getting additional training to widen their scope of practice if that's of interest. I guess I would just add one more thing, which is what you said earlier, Joel, which is any coach or any facilitator can, by studying human history and speaking with people about what they've walked and what they've lived, widen their heart's ability to receive painful information. And I think if we're going to, as a human family, attempt to restore any of the violence, genocide, racism, collective trauma that has been done by our ancestors and to which I believe it is our responsibility to address, then all of us have to cultivate a kind of compassion and extension to be willing to look at the shadow side of life and to bear witness to great pain. And I think that's something any one of us can commit to do to expand our heart's ability to do that. And I think now is the time. Nicholas, I don't know what you would add to that.
It's very rich what you say. And it comes back to you as a coach knowing exactly what your limitations are. And but also being clearer about that. And clearer, I often talk about the contract, like what contract you're going to set up with your client at the beginning. Even on a, without even talking about trauma, are you going to set up a contract where they're going to understand that you're going to often ask them what's happening inside them, not what they're only what they're thinking? That's already a very important part of them, a client understanding. That's going to be a very central part of what we do in this work, rather than constantly trying to figure things out. So it's a need for real clarity from coaches. And it's a more co it's a very complex territory in a way, because it also depends how we define the word trauma. But certainly, I think the more a coach does their own inner work, which has to be their first commitment, just as we would invite leaders to make that first commitment, the more naturally it becomes possible to work at deeper levels. And sometimes it's enough. This is, gets more complex, but you know, when someone, let's say, is in quite an emotional process, and you as the coach can feel this has an ancestral frequency here. Like, you know, your father, his father most probably had some of the feeling you're having now. And naming that and holding that together already amplifies a healing process. I mean,
Is helpful. And I think without getting too into the weeds on this particular topic, a question comes up around, you know, what is the need for coaches then? You know, why, in a sense, like, why not, why don't we just train an army of trauma therapists, you know, highly skilled trauma therapists? Like, yeah, what is the need for coaches in the in this sense?
And first of all, I think there's a continuum, but I think many coaches are capable of having extraordinary conversations and explorations with their clients that add incredible value. And they're straddling the interior life with the organizational dynamics, with the career trajectory, with their contribution and purpose in the world. Like they're holding a huge range of concerns for an executive that are not purely therapeutic in nature, but really meeting them in all the dimensions of their work-life balance and their well-being and health and their aspirations in the business and the things that are getting in their way and that they're not doing so productively. So I don't want to in any way discount coaching. And what I would say is that I think there's a threshold we're on where we're going to see coaches and therapists collaborating much more closely because we're going to need to, as things get more chaotic, attend to what are really psychological matters in the context of a larger coaching engagement. So I know Nicholas is and Mobius is starting to do these executive retreats where one executive or an executive, their spouse, come for 2 full days in private and work on a range of issues, some very leadership-centric in the foreground and some more psychotherapeutic in the foreground, but in combination so that you don't have to privatize your pain and think of your leadership as divorced from the insights you're gaining about your history, your family, your early childhood, your patterns, but that this can all be looked at holistically and comprehensively by two gifted and differently prepared practitioners. I think that's really the cutting edge of this work.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. And if we come out of the weeds for a moment, which is such a rich, we could have a whole podcast about this. What we're saying in the book, first of all, is that everything you do as a leader, the whole impact you have, the whole way you think, the whole way you respond, sits on your inner level of development. And coherence or varying degrees of fragmentation. For me, that's a core theme in the book, and I believe for Amy too. So, therefore, in one way or another, inner development needs to be the first priority, equally for the practitioner and for the leader, because everything we do depends on the whole way we see everything, the whole way we experience everything. Depends on our inner condition. So all our change initiatives are augmented or diminished according to our inner condition. And I think that's a principle that needs to be more widely understood. I've only come to understand it more deeply in the last year or two. Just the fullness of what that means. Because then we understand why I have to do my inner development. Because that's why when in all the leadership programs, of course we talk about the leadership landscape, but there's more emphasis on the inner development, because once certain points are released and opened, the whole way you perceive the landscape changes. The whole way you think about it, the whole way you feel the different people in it changes, according to your level of depth of presence and openness.
And I also want to honor the traditions of coaching. I mean, somatic coaching, ontological coaching, neurolinguistic coaching, presence-based coaching, gestalt coaching, all of these are practices that help coaches help leaders become more embodied, more emotionally ex open, more relationally attuned, more tied to their core values and purpose. So I don't want to suggest, I don't think we want to suggest that trauma work is the only high value kind of personal inner development. I would be very remiss to do that, but we would equally say we can't relegate it to the private treatment rooms of therapy any longer.
That seems like the massive opportunity, actually. It's like to not do that, to bring it into the developmental work we do in organizations. So as we come towards the end of our conversation, I'd love to ask about, in a sense, like the outcome maybe of our integrative work is that we can enact a different kind of leadership. And that phrase, to be a blessing. And in the book also, there was a sense of writing about, hey, what are you serving in the world as well? And I wonder if you could speak into that, and maybe anything that, as we come to the end, you'd like to make as an invitation to listeners.
Well, what could be more important now than each of us really trying to take responsibility for what we're transmitting into the world moment to moment to moment? What could be more important for all of us, I 100% include myself, or a leader, to really start to commit to looking as consciously as possible into what they're transmitting, how they're holding people, how they're thinking about situations, and ultimately, what are they wanting to contribute? What are they wanting to contribute? And ultimately, why are they here? Because my experience is that when most people look deeply enough, and someone put an amazing post on LinkedIn about the book the other day, where she said, when I'm asked about my purpose, I have a kind of corporate version. But actually, deep down, it's much deeper than that. It was a beautiful post, you remember? And she said that your book has helped me actually realize I need to stand deeper in who I really am. So what could be more important than that in this time of such pain and suffering and chaos, that people connect more and more deeply to their heart, to their innate, deep wanting to contribute? Everyone deep down wants that. And everyone deep down is looking for the way back to love. That for me has become very clear in even in the last few months. I see and feel that differently. That's actually the core topic. All the problems in the world come from a break in the flow of love, whether it's on a relationship level or a geopolitical level.
While Nicholas is talking, I'm thinking of this exquisite song by the a cappella group Sweet Honey in the Rock, which has a theme that says, "Will you harbor me?" And I think it's a time where things are going to get harrowing. Things are harrowing for many people on the planet as we're speaking. And we need to learn to be sanctuaries for one another. And the book ends really with a prayer that each of us increasingly can hold and embrace the hurt parts of ourselves, can witness and comfort and attend to the hurt parts of the fabric of life, and can dwell in the part of the heart that is never hurt and holds the eternal flame of the divine in sanctuary. And I think that's our fondest hope, that we increasingly become sanctuaries to one another.
Beautiful.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. Yeah, it feels like a really poignant place to bring our conversation to a close. And I really feel that that there's the timing of this book feels so pertinent, as you spoke to. And 26 has kind of started with a bang. And as you're saying, Amy, I don't know where we're heading. Things could get very challenging. So I hope this conversation serves as a harbor, in a sense, as a
Moment of
art,
refuge.
felt expression. Yeah. I'd
Thank
love to
you.
just read one thing quickly, Joel. It's
Please. Yeah. No,
from
you
the
can read
back
it
of
slowly as well if you like, yeah.
the... Okay. I usually read slowly. This is from Michael Watkins. In Leading in Chaos, ancient wisdom traditions speak to quarterly earnings. Trauma healing becomes organizational strategy. The body's intelligence supersedes the mind's calculations. Prayer and spreadsheets coexist. This isn't New Age wishful thinking, but a rigorous argument that unless we reunite body and mind, heart and strategy, sacred and secular, we will continue to create the conditions that threaten our species' survival.
Amen.
Amen to that. Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah.
Thank you, Joel, for the
Thank
depth
you.
of.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we can find the book on Amazon or other places and connect with you both on LinkedIn. Yeah.
We would love that.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is for me the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this. And it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches. Because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.